Elder's Own chiropractor, Kevin Reichlin. Yes, Kevin, we're claiming you, is enhancing the conversation to impact our health and advance healthcare. Your pain is a superpower. Learn to use it wisely. Our words for the wise, and the title of his book. So join us. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Kevin, to quote from your book, your pain is smarter than us. Use that to dive into calling your book, Your Pain is a Superpower.
You know, the reason I actually came up with that line was I was talking with one of my patients one time, and we were talking about the brilliance of healthcare today. The research, the technology is brilliant, and yet pain persists, particularly chronic pain. And we both just kind of said, well, it must be really smart. Because it's outsmarting technology, research. That's where that line came from. Tying that to your pain is a superpower. Pain opens doors for people. Certainly in my experience, when I've had physical, emotional pain in my life, I've learned from it. And every person I've ever met who's been through something challenging, hard, either physical pain or emotional pain, psychological pain, when they're through the other side, their insights have been life-changing. And we all know people like that.
Of course.
And so that's how those kind of tie together.
Right. Now, when you write all pain is in your brain, how does knowing that serve you as a practitioner and serve us as someone who might have chronic pain of some kind?
Yeah, for sure. Two things. I always say this to my patients. There's two things in your skull, your brain and you. That's it. Nobody else is up there. Your brain and you. And since all pain is in your brain, if we're going to change your brain, we got to change you.
Okay, well, having said that, beside your book, you've also written many blogs, and one was titled Neuromyths. Mm-hmm. And in your book, you write that the brain wires itself to social reality.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot more, I think, in your head. And how do you suggest people move from that social to their personal? And share an example, if you like.
Oh, great question. First of all, a really loving shout out to Lisa Feldman Barrett, who's written a couple of books. She's a PhD in Boston. She's the one where I took that line from, your brain and the social reality. I think the first thing you do is realize, A, your brain wires itself to the social reality it finds itself in. And once anybody accepts that as truth, now what do you do with it? And what you do with it is a couple of things. One, what has my social reality taught me? How much of my reality that I believe to be true based on what I've been taught, how much is that having an effect in my life today? And in my world, where that ties in with pain, is people are taught that pain is in your leg, for starters. And yes, you feel it in your leg. Absolutely, your knee hurts, right? But where's it coming from? And once you realize that it's coming from my brain, and yet my brain, some of the synapses up there have been created by the social reality, maybe if we start pulling those apart a little bit, maybe if we pull them apart, we can find a new way for you to experience your pain. Maybe your pain will decrease. Sometimes it goes up, by the way. For a while, of course.
Yes, that's an interesting piece about healing, isn't it? Both symptoms can flare up more. The
sure,
feeling part,
yeah. Sure. It's interesting to me that athletes consider pain to be good, but many of the rest of us think of pain as bad. You know, I'm a cyclist as well, and some of my happiest is when I'm hurting the most because I know I'll go faster. My mindset and my feel set is around the pain is actually okay. And that's another little bit of where I went with starting to change my perspective on pain, which is, how come sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad? And yet to your brain, pain is pain. So that tied in there a little bit.
Yes. And so the whole thing about judging something as good or bad, I don't know if this is good or bad. I must just wait and see.
Indeed.
Yes.
It's so true, right? Did you get to the spot about the chronic cycle pain and how that judgment of pain being wrong and bad just perpetuates it? We've been taught that it's bad. And as soon as your brain considers something bad, it wants to take care of you. So it creates an alarm. And if you've already got some pain, well, let's use that. Let's amplify it a little bit. And on and on and on.
Right. And George Kemble, who wrote the foreword in your book, said that you taught him to honor the alarm his body is sending. And how did that work for him?
I think George would say it worked really well.
But what was he dealing with or working with?
So he had had a long-term lower back issue that would just keep popping up and popping up over the years. And he had done chiropractic and physical therapy and a bunch of different stuff. And so one of the things I enjoy doing in my office is saying to folks, what's the definition of insanity? You know, we all know. And so let's try something different. And so I said to him, yeah, what else is going on? And it wasn't just the way he exercises. It wasn't just his diet. It was something else. By diving more into his psyche, he was able to look at some spots in his life that his lower back pain was trying to tell him he had to make some changes. And he did. And he's doing much, much, much better. He still gets it every once in a while. Mm-hmm. And I think he said that in the foreword.
Yes.
Doesn't happen anywhere near as much, not as long, and not as bad. And I predict within, I don't know, X amount of time, that will go away.
As long as he stays on that road to recovery, which is the road to exploration.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about this, but I think sometimes when people feel like, oh, I've found it, it becomes a stagnant factor in the whole process of life, which is always shifting.
Never ends, does it? The minute you get stagnant, you get stagnant. And yeah, there's a million analogies. So how do you keep moving? And isn't pain a great motivator for that?
Of course, yes. Do you have a first line of offense when someone comes to you with chronic pain and they've perhaps got to a point where it was better because they shifted their diet or their exercise or these external circumstances? Where do you go from there when there appears to be no solution for them?
Yeah, great question. First thing is I just listen. When I do my first intake with a chronic pain patient, it's usually 2 hours. And the reason it's 2 hours is I'll say to them, I want to hear your entire story. Tell me about from the time you were a kid. What comes to mind for you? It can be a circuitous, long circuitous path. But I find so many people, their doctors, their healthcare practitioners, never hear their whole story. And in that whole story is oftentimes something for them to look at. That's my first offense, or that's my first goal. I really want you to tell me everything that you need to tell me that you think is important. And then I'll start asking you questions, and that leads to more.
Right. I was going to say, I'm sure oftentimes something they don't even broach goes off as an alarm to you. Like, oh, okay, I see where this is stemming from. Just by the fact that nothing is mentioned by it. And you do some work with what you call biopsychology.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that. And I think it ties into when you talk about linear cause and effect of trauma. And I'm wondering when it becomes seemingly random, those are the things that we just don't see. The unspoken or research has only gone so far because a microscope can only go so far. What do you do with that as well? So start with the biopsychology. That was a long-winded question.
No, that was good. I was like, oh, there's about three answers there.
Good. We've got time.
Yeah. I started calling it biopsychology because bio to me means, you know, the biology, the body, the physiology, and psychology is your mind. And they're intricately connected. As I often say, there's all this data on our psychology, right? From Myers-Briggs to Enneagram to all the different DSMs, et cetera, you know, your various psychological conditions. And goodness knows there's a lot of info about biology, right? Well, what about where they intersect? And that's the uniqueness to each one of us. We're all unique. When the science hasn't figured it out, in either direction, maybe the answer is in that individual uniqueness that each person is. And it might seem random, but is it? So oftentimes, this seemingly random thing sparks. Here's an example. Recently, a patient said, I was sitting at a stop sign, I got rear-ended by a car. How is that my fault? And I said, I don't know, but the reality is this happened to you. Here it is. If you want to go down an esoteric path, maybe we can do that. I just don't know. But do we need to know? we can spend a lot of time looking at that. Or, yeah, you have some sprain, strain in your spine. Oh, by the way, quick backstory. This had happened years ago. Mm-hmm. And so that patient had long-term chronic pain. What I helped them do was get out of the why. The why didn't matter at that point. It's what do we want to do now?
Right. And if you want to ask why, great. But get ready. Pack a lunch. You can go there forever.
Right.
You are built in your mind to answer any question. So choose those questions wisely.
I love the term wisely. And it's kind of fun when you can come up with a why. Our mutual friend Prentice, who's been an ER doc for years and years and years, I've said to my patients for years and years, how many years did you go to medical school?
Zero.
Zero.
Thank goodness.
So if somebody comes into the studio and they're holding their wrist and they say, I just fell off my bike and what happened? What do you think happened? Broke their wrist, right? How many years of medical school did that take? Cause and effect with trauma is super simple. The treatment is super complex. No doubt about it. If somebody comes running in here and they're clutching their chest and they're feeling pain, how many years of medical school did that take? We all know that person's having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. The treatment is incredibly complex. But the why is simple. Moving around a little bit here, but to me, that's part of the issue with chronic pain is we're trying to put a trauma, simple cause and effect, which can work with trauma, but everything else, it's no longer simple. Matter of fact, I believe it's so complex that trying to get to that singular why, I think is impossible.
The why, cause and effect, is on the same realm of good and bad. You know, you're creating these two opposites, and within that land, you can spend your life, but not for a good purpose, as far as a patient certainly would be concerned. And then when you get to traversing that cause and effect, it's so easy, like this gentleman said, how is that my fault? The mind, and we want to move into that blame. That certainly is an interesting one because people get hung up there. I love how you wrote about children. Hmm. When children receive care, you're falling into that model of the external, here, I'm just going to give this to you. How do you work with children to start that suggestion of not the blame, but they can actually take some responsibility in their healing, in their recovery.
Right. A couple of things I'd say there. One, I almost didn't write that because I was so concerned that people would say, are you saying children shouldn't be treated or you shouldn't use antibiotics or you shouldn't do surgery or, you know, and in my history as a chiropractor, there's an absolute time for medication, surgery, chiropractic, anything.
Yes.
But I think with any of those choices of treatment, and to answer your question, how can you start teaching children at a young age agency? I have a part to play in this. So for me, with my kid patients, when they come in, I ask them a question. I don't care if they're, well, they have to be old enough to talk to me. But, you know, usually 8, 9, 10, around that age, I'll start saying, do you have any idea why this might have happened? Most of the time they'll go, no. But I at least asked them the question.
Right.
When they get older, then I can say, were you doing anything the day before? Have you been roughhousing? If the parents are in the room, I'm careful. But I would say, have you been drinking too much soda? Or nowadays, I'll talk to them about screen time. Are you sleeping? And all of it with a sense of curiosity. Never a blame, never a, right, you're a bad kid. It's just like, what are you doing? What might have led to this? Mm-hmm. So.
Yes, I had an interesting conversation with my granddaughter. She was a cheerleader, and they were trying to get them to try doing handsprings. She was afraid, but she thought she had to. And right before she tried, what happened in her head was her little voice said, don't do this. And she overrode the voice. Broke her arm, ended up with a steel rod in her arm. Of course, there's no blame there, but it's so important to ask questions and allow for that opportunity. I mean, there was a doctor I spoke with years ago, and he did a big study on children and near-death experiences. No one asked them any questions, what they went through while they experienced that, and it just led to this amazing awareness around that whole experience for everyone, and certainly enhanced recoveries and enhanced movement and consciousness, for lack of a better word there.
That's super cool. That is such a cool learning opportunity, right? To your point, no blame, no shame, just like, oh, so that little voice in your head. And I've done that with my own two stepsons. I've done that with adults. I've done that with my kid patients. And even saying to them, this happens to me. And I'm 64 and I still get the little voice. And occasionally I go, I'm going to ignore it. And, you know, sometimes I pay a price. Yeah. Why is that little voice little? Isn't that a funny old thing? Have you ever thought about that?
I haven't, but now that you say it, it's no little voice. I've had that voice since I was 12 years old, and it's never been wrong.
That's a huge point. I bet most people would say the little voice is never wrong. Don't you think?
Oh, yes.
I guess it's just
the inside voice, maybe not little.
Inside voice. There you go. Thank you. I totally agree.
I'm sure with your reputation, people are coming to you knowing they're not just coming in for an adjustment. Mm-hmm. What do you think really bumped you into really being able to take care of the full patient?
That's a great question. You said you've known that little voice since you were 12?
Inside voice.
Inside voice. Thank you. Thank you. I'll work on getting that.
Me too.
As far back as I can remember, I've just always known that there's more to humans than just their skin and bones. And I mean, duh. But I mean, I just always could tell that there's more to people than just what they think. That I just, even from the time I was a kid, people fascinated me. Mm. And I think I write that in the book. And that's the important word, people. It's interesting. So yes, my dad was a chiropractor. My dad worked really hard to discourage me from being a chiropractor. He actually encouraged me to be a medical doctor. Years later, he said it was because he had had so much persecution. And he also said, I don't want you to follow in my footsteps just because you're following in my footsteps. You know, be your own self. School, just learning all the diagnosis and pathology and radiology and all that bit. I love that stuff. But I was always interested in people.
Right. I loved when you talked about Dr. Ramachandran and his findings for phantom limb. And it's those kinds of things, I think, that are really bringing people more into there is not always an obvious cause and effect. And that is a huge lesson there. Could you share about his work and research?
I remember reading Dr. Ramachandran's book, Phantoms in the Brain. That was one of those books, I call those an oh no book. Because I read that book and I went, oh no, what do I do now? Because, you know, and there are
there are
studies I've read that are like, oh no, I use other words sometimes instead of no, but we're on the air.
Right.
Because they fly in the face of what I've been taught. First of all, I don't know if you've ever seen any of his YouTube videos.
No, I haven't.
He's a beautiful man. He's since retired. He saw a problem and talk about thinking outside the box. Creating his box with mirrors. Are you familiar with his mirror therapy?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I use it in my office, you know, for all kinds of stuff, if it's bilateral. Two things, by the way. Dr. Ramachandran's talk about phantom limb pain, to me, was kind of like the nail in the coffin that pain's in your brain. Mm. I mean, people lose a limb and they feel pain in that limb. They'll pass a lie detector test that their limb hurts. It's gone. Where's the pain? Right? For the listeners who don't know, what Dr. Ramachandran did is he had a patient who had lost his hand above the wrist in a motorcycle accident. And a common phantom limb sensation is clenching. And so this gentleman's hand was clenching so hard that wasn't there. Mm-hmm. He said he could feel his fingernails digging into his palm. And so Dr. Ramachandran, in a moment of divine inspiration, as he called it, he thought of the term smoke and mirrors. And he got an idea. And so he created a box, and he had the guy stick both arms into the box. But because of the mirrors, his eyes saw two hands. And he had the guy open his left hand, but he had his eyes were looking at that mirror, and he saw his right hand open, and his phantom limb started to unclench. Mm-hmm. He had him take the box home, use it over a weekend multiple times, if the clenching went away. And thus was mirror therapy born.
Mm, that's so wonderful.
Isn't it cool?
Yeah. Yeah, and I love that you said, in a moment of divine inspiration. Mm. Yeah, that's the part of continually moving and not thinking any one thing is going to always make the difference. So you gave an example of taking the bio aspect to knee pain. If you can give us just a brief description of what that looks like, because if you're working in Boulder as a chiropractor, you're working with athletes from elite level down to I'm going jogging this morning before work.
Right. By the bio aspect, you mean more what do I do physically for that?
Yeah. How do you look at that and work with it?
Yeah. So
as an example.
Taking a knee, take the history. How did it happen? What does the current pain feel like? Then that helps with some of the diagnosis. And then it's a matter of, for me, I use lasers in my office. They've been around for about 20 years. I was one of the early adopters of that since late 90s. So often with knee pain, a quadriceps and a glute are weak. And if you look at the neurology of things, and I talk about this in the book, muscle memory, right? There's no such thing as muscle memory. People really struggle with that. But if muscle memory existed, then sadly a person with spinal cord injury would be able to walk. Nothing happened to their muscles. Right. Where's the memory? It's in the nerves. And so if you've got a knee that's in pain, you're going to have to strengthen and stabilize and all that kind of stuff with the knee, and that requires exercise. But if you don't deal with the underlying neurology, you're not going to get a full response. And so I use lasers to help the nerves recommunicate with those muscles. And then I'm no different than anybody else. It's standard physical therapy to strengthen. I will adjust the knee. Sometimes I'll adjust the pelvis, sometimes the ankle.
Of course.
Look at the chain, all of that
present differently,
stuff.
Yes.
And then everybody gets biopsychology sprinkled in, neuroscience. How's your brain going to react to this? How's your psyche going to react to this? How are you doing with your identity as a runner? And now you might not run again. That's a big one for people with knees in Boulder.
Oh, yeah.
Right? What do you mean I can't run? I've lost patients because I will say to them, if you're not willing to stop for a little while, I can't work with you. It's not fair to you, right? So are you willing to stop? And if they're not willing to stop, they're still a great person. I'll tell them, you're still a really nice person, but I don't think my work's going to work.
Mm. You just said you bring up the psychology. I'm a proponent of like that doctor's inspiration coming from that unknown, mm-hmm. very well-known place that's more mysterious than unknown, since we're playing with words inside and big little voices and that sort of thing. How do you approach that? Meditation?
Whatever your spiritual practice or your meditative practice or whatever realm that falls into, mm-hmm. your expansive awareness practice, that's one I kind of like lately. Of course, keep doing it. Absolutely.
But is it part of your protocol to suggest that for people?
Oftentimes, I will say to people, do you have a particular spiritual or meditative practice that you do regularly? And if they say yes, I'll oftentimes say, do you know how or does your practice allow you to aim it at your knee? Because you had asked about a knee or your chronic pain or clarity, whatever we're trying to work on. Mm-hmm. So yes, I will do that regularly.
Is there something that comes to mind right now that you would wipe out of human consciousness in order for people to be healthier?
Wow, wouldn't that be a superpower? that's a great question. What would I wipe out? That they're victims to their brains, that they don't have agency. Mm-hmm. I'm used to saying it in the plus way, I would say, wipe it out and say, you have a prefrontal cortex. You know, you have this amazing creation that allows you to actually work with your brain. You're not a victim to it. Yeah, it may do something to you because it's programmed from the social reality it founds itself in, but you have awareness and you can use that superpower to change.
So Kevin, how do you work with that difficult case? I'm not asking for you'll try the laser or you'll do adjustments. Do you give yourself permission to not take on any blame of why can't I fix this? Hopefully there's another rabbit hole you can discover.
I often take it personally when things don't work. Somebody asked me recently about that, and I said, you know, most days when I drive to work in the morning, it's not the most comfortable thing. I have fear that I won't be able to help everybody, even mm-hmm. though I know I can't help everybody. Right. It's still hard for me. So I don't know if that means I take it on, but I take responsibility. Yeah, I don't take, if people blame me for something, if I made a mistake, I'll absolutely own up to it. And I'm totally comfortable saying, I don't know. I'm totally comfortable. If somebody presents something to me and I don't know what's going on, I will say, I need some time. Let me think this through. Come back in a couple of days. And on occasion, I've sent an email to a person saying, I just don't think I'm your guy. I can't figure this out. Yeah. So I think those are my strategies.
Yes. I appreciate your honesty. One of my personal favorite teachers was because he would say, I don't know.
Who can know everything?
Yeah, yeah. It's great. And it's all part of breaking down the word responsibility. It's an ability to respond in the moment. And that's all it is. There's no real weight to it. So we just have to let ourselves move from there. As you've participated and watched healthcare and medical research for over your lifetime, really, what would you like to share with us today about what you've learned?
What medical research has created and technology in my 40-year career has been spectacular. What we can do for people with testing and techniques and all that bit is nothing less than spectacular. And there's a both and. And there's a whole nother piece, which is the person. That's what I would leave you with. So chiropractor, people have spines. Spines don't have people. I treat people. I do treat spines, but I treat people. And in healthcare, the technology and all the techniques and all the research will work even better if people are brought into the picture, not just their condition.
Wonderful.
You know, your pain is a superpower. Learn to use it wisely. Mm-hmm. The last chapter in my book is IQ plus EQ equals WQ. Particularly, I speak to, as we get a little bit older, starting usually in our 40s or 50s, we start worrying that we can't remember things and we see it as wrong and bad. And so if you read that chapter, sure, there is neurodegenerative disorders, Alzheimer's, dementia, and those are terrible. But most of us are not experiencing that. I believe we're experiencing something different in our brains, and it has to do with wisdom. And wisdom is a whole different way of using our brains and our minds than instantaneous data recall. And I think there's a lot there to be discussed.
Oh, I think that sounds like a wonderful new book.
I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, I interviewed this man one time, and this guy said, just point blank, aging is not a medical scenario. It's a spiritual scenario. He wasn't dissing any kind of medicine, but first it was that. I think all conditions are first that. As you said, they're the person. So do that piece, who we are, who we truly are first, and then go out and reach out, and you'll have more success finding what you need, I think.
I wholeheartedly agree.
That's your whole person. That's what you walked in with today.
Yeah, thank you. Right on.
Thank you, Kevin Reichlin, author of Your Pain is a Superpower, Learn to Use It Wisely. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.